from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Tui Vu, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening segment this morning, the battle over same-sex marriage will finally have its day in the highest court in the country. The U.S. Supreme Court is set to hear arguments tomorrow on whether Proposition 8, California's ban on same-sex marriage, is constitutional or not. Then at 9:30, the head of Amnesty International, Salil Shetty, joins us to discuss the group's approach to massacres in Syria, Guantanamo Bay prisoners, and the arms trade. Join us for Forum next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Tui Vu, in for Michael Krasny. Proposition 8, the ban on same-sex marriage that California voters approved in 2008, is getting its day in the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow. And the following day, the justices will hear a case challenging the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. The arguments on both sides have touched off a passionate and national conversation on morality, fairness, and justice. Our guests today are Hastings Law School professor David Levine.
Good morning, Tui.
Good morning. And Scott Schaefer, host of KQED's The California Report. Scott joins us from Washington, where he's covering the Supreme Court hearings this week. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Tui. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you both for joining us. Scott, let's begin with you. What can we expect tomorrow? Set the stage, if you will. How much time will the parties have to present their arguments in both cases tomorrow and Wednesday? And can we expect to hear anything new?
Well, there have been crowds gathering outside the Supreme Court, people in line. So there's a lot of excitement about this case. People want to be a part of history. In terms of the arguments tomorrow, it's scheduled to be 1 hour long, starting at 10 a.m., 7 a.m. Pacific time. And each side gets 30 minutes. The opponents of Prop 8 will go first, and they're going to split their time. They're going to get 20 minutes of that 30 minutes to argue that Proposition 8 violates the U.S. Constitution. And then the last 10 minutes of that 30 will go to the Solicitor General. That's President Obama's attorney, essentially. And he will be arguing why the federal government would also like to see Prop 8 fall. And so they'll take that first half an hour, and then the proponents of Proposition 8 will get the rest of the time. Now, of course, it can go over an hour. The justices, I don't believe, have anything else on their calendar tomorrow in terms of oral arguments. So it could go a little longer, but we expect that to go about until 11 o'clock. In terms of will there be anything new? Well, both sides have filed their briefs, and this has been argued now for, 4 years in the
right.
courts, and so I don't think there's going to be anything. But the big question is, what do the justices think? What do they care about? What questions do they ask? That's what'll be new.
Well, let me ask Hastings Law School professor David Levine about that. Do you think the court will indeed decide whether the Constitution guarantees a right to same-sex marriage, or are there a number of other options they could be looking at?
Well, there's so many options between these two cases. I was thinking we ought to call this legal March Madness, because the situation is such that you could end up with a decision where it's much ado about nothing, and we'll end up with almost no change in the law at all, or we could end up in a situation where we have this total new day where every single state in the country is going to have to figure out how they can quickly arrange for same-sex marriage, and there's a lot in between.
What are the in-betweens? Can they say, for example, that the conservatives who support Prop 8 don't have legal standing to
Correct.
Do this?
Correct. One way to do it would be, in the Prop 8 case, is to say the people who are bringing the challenge to U.S. Supreme Court have no right to do so. And if that happens, then what we'll be left with is Judge Walker's district court opinion, which would mean that California would have Proposition 8 go away as a practical matter, but it wouldn't affect any other place in the country.
And I think President Obama has been pushing something called the eight-state solution. What is that?
Right. Well, what the eight-state solution is really a twist on separate but equal. Is the idea is that those states that have arranged for domestic partnerships, civil unions, something short of marriage for same-sex couples, just can't do that. The situation would be that if you want to have traditional marriage, you're allowed to do that in a state. But if you want to make a change, one change you can't make is something where you're creating second-class status. And in effect, it would be all or nothing. So the eight states would be those that have domestic partnerships. They would have to drop that, and presumably they would all go to same-sex marriage, and that would include California.
Scott Schaefer, you're there in Washington. You've been covering this extensively, I know. Among the nine justices, who's considered a swing vote?
Well, Justice Kennedy is always considered a swing vote, although sometimes it turns out that he's not. As with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, everyone was looking to him, and it turned out to be a 5-4 decision. He was in the minority on that one. But certainly he has written in the past two sort of landmark decisions in support of gay rights, Romer versus Evans in Colorado, striking down an amendment there that took away rights and prevented domestic partnerships and other legal protections for gays and lesbians. He wrote that ruling. And he also wrote the Lawrence v. Texas decision, striking down sodomy laws in California. And both were fairly strong pronouncements about the rights of gays and lesbians to participate fully in society. And certainly opponents of Prop 8 look to those rulings and say with hope that, that the same kind of reasoning can be applied here and strike down Proposition 8 and perhaps go even further. And, you know, as they're swinging for the fences here, as David suggested, they're asking for the court to say that there is a fundamental right to marriage that exists for everyone that cannot be denied on the basis of sexual orientation. So so that's sort of the play, you know, where the field is at this point.
And is he the main swing vote? Anybody else who's considered a swing vote?
Well, there are a couple of other interesting possibilities. Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, who was, of course, the fifth vote to uphold most of Obamacare. There's several people say that there is reason to think that his vote could be in play. First of all, he's fairly young, and he's going to be around for another 20 years or so, presumably. Mm-hmm. And he sees where this is going in terms of the culture. And so does he really want to be on the quote-unquote wrong side of history and be part of a majority that upholds Proposition 8 or upholds DOMA? Secondly, the main argument for the Yes on 8 folks is that marriage is a critical institution that unites the biological children with their mother and father, and that that's the best arrangement for those kids. Well, turns out, you know, Justice Roberts and his wife have adopted a couple of children. They're not the biological parents, and I'm sure they feel that they're doing a perfectly fine job. So there's, you know, there's some question about whether that argument will rub him the wrong way. And then finally, and this is just sort of, I don't know what impact this would have, but there was an article today in the Los Angeles Times that his cousin, who lives in San Francisco, is a lesbian and very open in the family, well known to him. She's going to be in the courtroom sitting in his section for friends and family. So, you know, and that brings up a bigger issue around these kinds of legal questions, which is that, especially in Washington, D.C., in legal circles and political circles, most of these judges, many of them know people who are gay or lesbian. And the question is, whether they're in their family or in their law practice or in their circle of social circle, does it have an impact on them, as it has seemingly through the polls, on other Americans, to know someone who's gay? Does that change the way you think about these questions?
We're discussing California's Prop 8, the ban on same-sex marriage, which the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments on starting tomorrow. And then the High Court will also be taking up the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, on Wednesday. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Or you can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And David, let me ask you this. You know, Scott brought up the issue of history earlier. And speaking of history, how much of a shadow does Roe versus Wade cast on this? I mean, that 1973 ruling pretty much established a constitutional right to abortion. And now a number of legal experts think the decision perhaps went too far, too fast, and created a culture war. Is there a similar concern here?
Well, it's interesting because one of the people who has made that exact criticism is Justice Ginsburg.
Yes,
She's well known for saying in many places, at Hastings as well as at other law schools, she thinks Roe versus Wade did go too far. And one way the justices might take what's going on, and you know what we're seeing before our eyes, of course, is that every day it seems like somebody else who you wouldn't expect is coming out in favor of same-sex marriage. We had the senator last week, Secretary Clinton, and the justices could easily say, you know, this is a situation where we should just stay out of it because the politics are changing and there's no need to exercise the Constitution in this situation and just let the politics flow and we're going to have same-sex marriage one way or the other. It might take a little longer.
As a group, are the current justices more or less conservative than the court of the 1970s that decided Roe versus Wade?
Well, conventionally speaking, they're considered among the most conservative set of justices we've ever had. They certainly are significantly more conservative than the 7-2 majority that decided Roe versus Wade, that never saw a big tsunami coming about the pro-life movement. And so that's a piece of this. Now, one of the things I was thinking when Scott Schaefer was speaking is a way that the justices might act, quote, conservatively, unquote, and still come out in favor of same-sex marriage would be in the Prop 8 case would be to take the position that the proponents of Prop 8 have no standing. It's a very tricky legal issue. And if they decided the case that way, they would do something that is conventionally conservative, which is to make the courthouse doors hard to open for certain kinds of plaintiffs. In this case, they would be conservative plaintiffs. And we'd end up with the result that the Prop 8 would go down in California. And there's a similar argument to be made in the case the day after in the Defense of Marriage Act. So they could be quite conservative and yet come up with a liberal result.
On what grounds would they be able to say that the proponents of Prop 8 have no standing because they're not personally injured in any way?
That's right. The conventional way of thinking about standing, to go into court, you can't just say you're bothered by an issue. You have to have what we colloquially say is a stake in the outcome. You have to have a reason to be in court. And the Prop 8 proponents really have no conventional reason to be in court. What their best argument is that the California Supreme Court in a 7-0 decision said that proponents of a proposition have to be allowed to step into court in the shoes of the state of California in a situation like we have now, which is that the governor and the attorney general of California refused to defend Prop 8. And the California Supreme Court said, in that circumstance, the proponents can step in. Now, whether the U.S. Supreme Court will say that's good enough for federal purposes is a very open question. Again, Justice Ginsburg wrote an opinion, a 9-0 opinion about 20 years ago in a proposition case out of Arizona, where she said, I think it was very dubious, I think is the quote, that there was standing in this situation. So she's going to have to change her mind on that to say that this is a there's a distinction here. Or, again, she could kind of lead everybody in the same direction and say no standing. And, oh, by the way, same-sex marriage in California will happen.
And, Twee, I would say, and I'm not sure if David would agree, but I think that the case for standing is even a little shakier in the DOMA situation, because in that case, the lower court struck down DOMA, and the Justice Department is appealing, even though they agree with the decision, and so and they're refusing to defend it, DOMA, that is, Section 3 of DOMA. And so an advisory committee of the House of Representatives, mostly Republicans, stepped in and got the funds to hire an attorney who is defending DOMA. And so there's a real big question there as to whether they can do that. And so, as David said earlier, it's entirely possible that both of these cases could be, you know, they will not get to the merits and the question of equal protection and whether there's a right to same-sex marriage, because neither of these folks have standing to even be in court tomorrow and Wednesday.
Very interesting. Let me bring our listeners into the conversation here. Colin in San Francisco, you're on Forum. Welcome.
Good morning. My question will be for Professor Levine. Regarding the Equal Protection Clause and how it applies to the fact that same-sex couples who were able to marry before the passage of Proposition 8, there are approximately, I understand, 20,000 of us, are given one set of rights, and similarly situated couples who have applied for marriage licenses after the passage are being denied based on a simply what seems to be very arbitrary and capricious manner, simply because of the timing of when we came to the court for the registrar for the marriage license.
Well, the caller is absolutely right. In fact, we really have several categories in California. You have heterosexual couples. We have the 16,000 to 18,000, 20,000, the caller said, couples who were able to marry after the California Supreme Court knocked down the predecessor to Prop 8. And then we have these couples who, at best, they can have domestic partnerships. The argument that there's a rational distinction among those groups really falls apart in California. The idea that we can have those groups and that there's some state justification for it is exceedingly weak. So if the Supreme Court gets to the merits, one way they could go, essentially the way the Ninth Circuit went, which was to say there's no justification in California. So you could end up with a California-only solution that knocks down Prop 8, in part on exactly the grounds the caller has said.
Scott, did you want to add to that at all?
No, it just points to how complicated this is for couples because, you know, and this is an argument that the opponents of Prop 8 have made from the very beginning, is that in California you've got people who want to get married and can't. You've got people who are married, who got married in that window of time, but they can't get remarried if their spouse dies or they get divorced. Can they even get divorced? I mean, can they get divorced if they move to a state where same-sex marriage isn't legal? So there's just a lot of complications that arise from these distinctions that are made from the various ways in which states view same-sex marriage and the federal government as well.
Colin, are you happy with the answers? Anything else you'd like to follow up with?
Nothing. Thank you.
Okay. You're quite welcome. Thanks for joining us. I'll throw this question out to both of you, beginning with Professor Levine. Is this the defining civil rights debate of our time?
Well, I mean, it's certainly one of them. I mean, in my lifetime, race, gender, and now sexual orientation, we're seeing sea changes in all of those. Certainly in this immediate time period, I think that's absolutely right, that this is the civil rights issue that's out there. It's hard to see anything else. Maybe immigration is going to be the next one that's going to be flowing. But right now, I think this is absolutely the civil rights issue of our time.
And I would add to it, I remember when Prop 8 was on the ballot, and there was a lot of discussion and efforts on both sides to get the African-American and the Latino votes in particular. And President Obama, although he kind of opposed Prop 8, didn't say much about it. And after the election, the analysis of who voted for it, it did seem that people of color, African-Americans, voted for Prop 8 in larger numbers because they didn't like that connection. They didn't like gay marriage being equated with the civil rights struggles that they went through in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and some would say still going through. But I think that has changed, and you see it in the polls. There was a field poll recently that showed African-American support for gay marriage going up above, I think, 50% now. And you have to wonder whether or not President Obama coming out in favor in support of gay marriage hasn't had a real impact on the African-American community and the Latino community. So I think that people are maybe warming up to the notion that this is a civil rights issue, the way in which other civil rights struggles of the past were.
You know, a number of people have been writing into us to us as well on our website. Phil sent us an email. I'm getting tired of the gay marriage caucus race. He says there is a simple solution, but everyone is so invested in their own argument, they can't think rationally. The solution is to strike all mention of marriage in law. Let the government deal with civil unions to assure due process and let religions deal with marriage as they wish. It's a simple matter of separation of church and state. And Kurt
writes, it's funny because Judge Walker actually said that very, very early in the trial back in 2010. He goes, why is the government even involved in marriage? He didn't return to that thought very much during the trial, but he did say it out loud.
You know, also there was a moment with the California Supreme Court, Scott, you may remember, at the end of the second or part of the second opinion where Prop 22 was knocked down, where that opinion doesn't say California had to have same-sex marriage. What it said is we had to have the same thing and that you couldn't have two classes. There was no reason for that. And so at that moment, we might have gone to domestic partnerships or civil unions, but then Prop 8 came along and it's just changed the debate.
And there are some countries in Europe, I think, that do it more or less that way. You go to the city hall to get your marriage license, and then you have a ceremony somewhere in the church or synagogue or mosque of your choice.
Some other interesting emails here from our listeners. George writes, I can't seem to find where it is stated that marriage is a right for all citizens. Getting a marriage license is like getting a driver's license or a contractor's license or a business license. You need to meet the qualifications and apply. It's not for everyone by right. It's open to those who qualify, like getting a PhD. What do you make of that?
Well, the United States Supreme Court, I understand, has 14 times has said that marriage is a fundamental right. Now, it is true, though, the word marriage does not appear in the United States Constitution, but the U.S. Supreme Court has said that this is one of the fundamental rights that we have. The issue is it something that the state can define in a particular way or not? Judge Walker's opinion said it was just improper to define marriage in such a way as to deny this fundamental right to people who just happen to be homosexual or lesbian. And it's that question. And what you have is this traditionally, states get to regulate this. And it comes back to the case for Wednesday, which is the core of the case for the DOMA case is states ought to be able to choose whether or not same-sex couples can marry, and the federal government ought to honor that. And in the Prop 8 case, at least for the opponents of Prop 8, they're saying there's no choice. The only choice states can make is to allow same-sex marriage. So there's a little tension between the arguments in those two cases.
Scott, I know I'm asking you to read the tea leaves here, but I mean, what are the chances that the justices will want to encroach on the territory of state legislators?
Well, that's always the question is, you know, I think that just when he was visiting California a few weeks ago, Justice Kennedy, I think he was speaking maybe at Hastings for all I know, but I think it was up in Sacramento. And he was saying that, you know, and he wasn't speaking about this in particular, but he said, you know, people shouldn't look to these nine unelected justices on the Supreme Court to settle these big questions. And I think he may have been talking about other issues, had other issues in mind, whether it was abortion or affirmative action. You know, there's a good argument for allowing these things to play out through the legislature and the voters and the ballot boxes. And so personally, I'll be looking listening very carefully tomorrow and Wednesday to see how much skepticism the justices express and who expresses it. We referred to Justice Ginsburg earlier, and I think that she has seemed to be reluctant to go for that 50-state solution. And, you know, perhaps they may not want to uphold Prop 8, but I'll be surprised if they also decide that they want to tell Mississippi and Texas and Arkansas that they have to have gay marriage. That would really be the kind of ruling that Justice Kennedy seemed to be arguing against when he was speaking just the other day in California.
Okay, we've only got about a minute and a half left here, but let me take one more call. Brian in San Francisco, welcome to Forum.
Hi. So I just want to know, if gay marriage becomes legal again, what would happen if a priest or a rabbi or an imam basically did not want to perform a marriage in their church or temple or synagogue?
Well, I think there's nothing about the legal arguments in these cases that say that a religious group is going to have to solemnize marriages. That's outside of what we're talking about today. So if in any of these religious groups, if they didn't want to recognize same-sex couples, if the religious figures didn't want to be part of those, nobody's going to force them to do that.
Scott, you get the last word.
Well, I was just going to say, I'll see if I can be brief, but yeah, that opponents of gay marriage say, well, maybe, you know, priests won't be forced to do it, but what about, say, adoption agencies? Will they be forced to give equal preference or equal, you know, opportunity to same-sex couples as opposite-sex couples to adopt children? And so that's a concern they're raising on what would be some of the consequences, intended or otherwise, if gay marriage is established as a fundamental right.
All right. Well, thank you to you both. We were joined by David Levine, a law professor at UC Hastings, and Scott Schaefer, reporter and host of KQED's The California Report. He's in Washington covering the court case this week. Thank you both. I'm Tui Vu here for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.